Session number 11208.
Major Eric Hooper, Reel 8. We were talking about the Gazala breakout, I wondered why, if the 9th Battalion were able to go out so without being attacked through the Tobruk route, why the rest of the brigade hadn't retired that way. Could you just clear that up for me?
When you say the rest of the brigade, you mean brigade headquarters or the other brigade?
The 8th and the 6th and.
The 8th, they were more or less put in the box. They were taking prisoners most of
That's
the
right.
8th,
Wouldn't
yes.
it have been better if they'd retired the same route as the 9th had gone then? And we'd
Uh,
been able
well,
to
well,
work.
uh, 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 well, I'm afraid I don't know exactly what happened there, but I should imagine what happened was that they were overpowered, the 8th, because I think Harry Seller was taken prisoner there.
Would they not have been better then to have come the way you went instead of breaking out and going round?
Well, when you look at it, I think yes. Because I tell you what happened, as far as I was concerned, I got right through to Tobruk without well, no, I'm not. I'm going to say without anything happening. But I was going down an escarpment, and I was attacked by a Stuka, and he dropped two bombs. And it's very funny this. These Stukas, they had a bomb on each wing, and there was a propeller with a wire through, like a split pin, and the wire was attached to the underside of the plane, and when the bomb was dropped, the wire remained intact, and it came, and it allowed the propeller to start to revolve on its way down, and by the time it normally hit the ground, the propeller is off, and then the bomb is ready to explode and hit the ground. But what happened on this occasion was that I saw both bombs drop, and as it was dropping, the propeller was going, hit the ground, and didn't explode, and it bounced up, and the propeller dropped off, and it dropped again and exploded. By then, I was out the truck, and I was okay. Even the truck wasn't damaged, and then I carried on.
But that was the only German action against you, as far as.
Well, no, as What I did, instead of going on, I got down to the main road, the coastal road to Tobruk, but instead of going along the road, I went across into the rough ground, and I travelled towards Tobruk in that way. And then, of course, once or twice I was machine gunned by aircraft, but I got to Tobruk.
It does sound as if that was the better way out.
Yes, yes.
Or do you think the fact that, or was it perhaps that the 8th and 6th attack went out the other way that provided the diversion?
Well, it's possible, you see. It's one of those things, on the face of it, I would have thought if it just made our way to Tobruk
As a brigade.
and as a brigade and left a rear party in defence, to let the enemy still think that we're still holding position, and then after we got to a certain distance away, then for them to pack up and come back. In other words, they leave somebody to fight the rearguard action.
So, to your mind, the actual breakout, the forward and sideward and westward breakout, was perhaps not necessary.
I don't think so. No.
So, what happened next then to you?
Well, what happened was I carried on, and
You had a driver with you, I
Oh,
presume.
yes, I had a driver, yes. I had a driver and a batman. In fact, I was doing it, I was driving at the time when we were attacked by the Stuka.
So, you took it in
Oh,
turns.
yes. Well, as a matter of fact, I prefer driving myself.
Why was that?
Well, I think I had more confidence in driving. Because, we had a lot of army drivers who never driven them before, and they got their experience in driving with army trucks, and I'd done a lot of driving in civilian life before then,
So you were driving back.
Well, what happened was, and I carried on, and I stopped at Tobruk, and I went down to the water's edge, and I stripped, and I had a bathe. And then I had a wash and shave, and then had something to eat, because we always carried plenty of rations with us, emergency rations. and then went down to Mosmatru, where there's a big transit camp. Well, they were still functioning. And I stopped there for a couple of days, and until I could get information as to where Brigade Headquarters had got themselves to.
Did you see any sign of the 9th after this?
No. Oh, no, yes, we did. When I was at Mosmatru, the quartermaster of the 9th, Ted Love, he came in and asked him what the position was, and he didn't know a great deal. But later on, I found out that the brigade headquarters was stationed at a certain point in the desert, so I got the map reference, and then I went and joined up with them again.
And they were at...
I can't remember the name of the place, but I'll tell you one thing. It was about 4 miles from Fort Madalena.
That's close enough. Yeah.
Yes, because I'll tell you what was happening. We were getting spotter planes, we were going out, British spotter planes, of course, and coming back with map references where they saw stragglers right down in the desert, where they'd gone west and then south. And, there were only two or three, or the occasional truck.
So and these would be members of the 8th and 6th?
Where they could be all odds and sods, you see? And, again, I was once or twice I had to go across there with a map reference to at Fort Madalena. They'd stationed some vehicles and supplies there, and I was taking them in the map references to these people to go with the trucks to try and to get these people and bring them in. And that was a time I remember, the first time I did that particular job, the brigade intelligence officer, he had been down, and I saw him leaving as I was just going to Fort Madalena, and that was the last time I saw him. He finished up in the bag as a prisoner of war. Because when I got back, they'd asked me if I'd seen him, and I said, yes, I saw him leaving. He said, well, he hasn't got back yet. So he must have gotten... well, obviously he was captured. I don't know how, but that was it.
So you were doing these missions to get the waste and strays. What happened then?
Well, after that, we just sort of... there was no other action for us, and we went back to Mariopolis.
Now,
just outside Alexander.
Was this when Crusher Nichols was replaced?
Yes, he was replaced then, and then later on.
Do you know why he was replaced? Was
he got promotion to divisional commander, and then my old battalion commander, Colonel Percy, he took a command of brigade headquarters.
How did you what did you think of that? Were you pleased or otherwise?
Well, I don't know it. I knew Colonel Percy very well because I'd been his adjutant for a little while in Tiverton.
How did he compare to Crusher Nichols? As a brigadier.
Well, I don't know now. Colonel Percy, he was, he was a First World War officer. And, of course, to become brigadier as a regular officer, that was something, you know. It probably is one of his ambitions and, for this sort of thing. And I think he was... I don't know what the word is, you know. I think honestly, I think it was too big for him. He was very, very nervous. He always at night time he just lay on his bed or his wherever he lay in his full dress with his tin helmet on one side. He never took any of his clothes off, even at brigade headquarters.
So you were at Mariopolis. What were you doing there?
Oh, well, at Mariopolis, we're just resting, and...
Was the brigade being rebuilt, or...?
Well, Well, it what was being reassembled, and so was the whole. The, in fact, the whole of the brigade, you know, the 68th and 9th ELI, and all the supporting troops, they were being. They were being put together. But wait a minute now. I think I missed something out here. Yes, that's right. I said I'd missed something out. Now, what it was, I coming back from Gazala. I met up with Colonel Dewing, who was the commanding officer of the 74th Field Regiment.
Was this before you got to Madalena? Before you got to Mario?
That I just can't remember now. I think it definitely was. Yes, I'm sure. Yes, it definitely was. He gave me. We stopped at a place outside Fuka, which was an airstrip there, and he gave me a message to take to the CRE, who was somewhere beside Fuka, and this message depicted our position and what troops he had at his command, and he was awaiting the CRE's command as to what to do. Well, I was going in my vehicle, and I went through a little pass, and there was a lager of vehicles. And they all had our distinguishing marks on them. So I went just through this lager, and I turned right at a railway crossing, and I was going towards the signal box when I was fired upon. And I wasn't driving at the time, but I told the driver to turn round slowly and make his way slowly back. And we came back through this lager again of vehicles, and then I noticed that the gunfire had awoken these troops, and they were Germans. And I just went slowly through and got through the gap and went and told Colonel Dewing exactly what the situation was and what was happening. And he told everybody to pack up, and away we made our way back through the desert, and we eventually got to... Well, I think it was Fort Madalena after that.
So before Madalena.
Mm, yes.
Mm. Okay, so now, jumping back to when you were Mariupolis, is there any other points you'd like to make? Because from here you were sent on a course, weren't you,
yes.
At Gaza. Was there anything else that comes to mind before that?
Oh, no. What happened was then the troops were given a lot... they were taken out at night time. You know, there were tricks laid on to take them out to Alexander to give them as much... leisure time as possible, you know, relaxation and what have you. That was the main thing at the time. And all officers as well, and NCOs, were sent on various courses. And this is when I went to Gaza on an admin course.
And what exactly, what was this course about? What did you actually do on the course, and how long did it take?
Well, the course was about a fortnight. And I'll tell you, it was quite a strenuous course, because we were up in the morning, probably about 7 o'clock, and we had an hour's lecture before breakfast, and then we had lectures throughout the day, and we even had a lecture at night time after the evening meal.
And what were the lectures in?
Well, on general admin and...
pertaining to what, I mean? Sorry.
More or less pertaining to supplies, where the supplies originate from, you know, and how they're brought up, and to eventually how they get to shall we say, battalion headquarters, through the various DIDs, you know, detail issue dumps and so on. The different jobs that the RASC had to do, and the Royal Army Ordnance Corps, what their functions was.
So it wasn't sort of office administration, it was supply administration.
Supply administration. And we were taken to a what they call a bridgehead, where the trains used to come in with the supplies, and, you know, shown as, you know, what was what, and then eventually told where it was going to.
So do you think you were being groomed as a staff officer at this time then?
No, I don't think so. I think it was just instead of... they had a chance, I think, for officers to learn something rather than sitting on their backside doing sort of nothing. And Well, you did learn something from it. It was advantage to me because I eventually went back to battalion headquarters, and I used to be the stand-in for the quartermaster when he went on leave.
So you went when you rejoined them. They were still at Mariupolis, were they?
Oh, the brigade headquarters. Oh yes, I remained with brigade headquarters until we came back to England after the we finished up in Tunisia.
So the next thing that happened was you went forward to the Alamein Ridge, I think. Can you explain?
Oh yes. I'd say to the. Again, it was a case of just putting our little area in defence until we went forward to Alamein.
Where exactly was the position you took up?
In the ridge through Ruwaisat Ridge, I think it was called.
Was that in front of the Katara Depression?
It was in front, yes.
And were your jobs the same as before?
The same as before, yes.
So, if you just take us through the events then, what happened next, as far as you were concerned?
Well, we had to take some of the defence platoon out at night time and sort of dig slip trenches again, you know, to put the brigade headquarters in a sort of a semi-state of defence. I don't think there's much more I can remember what happened there. You know, things happen so quickly.
Did you meet Montgomery at all before the actual battle, or did you visit brigade headquarters more?
I met Montgomery before we broke through at Alamein.
And what was your initial impression? Because he didn't have the reputation then he had after Alamein.
Well, what impression I got was, you know, Montgomery went round as many of the troops as possible to talk to them. He came along in his jeep and he just stood and talked to them. But we had to have all of the troops bullshitted up to the nines. And we're all on parade, and he came along. I called him to attention and gave him the, you know, smart salute and told him, brigade headquarters on parade, ready for your inspection, sir. And he just, oh, well, what are you standing there for? No, come round here, you know. And then he just talked, you know, who are you, you know, to the troops. And they said, oh, brigade headquarters. Oh, he says, a lot of paperwork here, isn't there? And the bloke said, no, a lot of digging and what have you. And that sort of thing, and the way he went.
And what did you think of his performance? Did it impress you? I mean,
no, I wasn't impressed.
Why not?
I don't know. But I tell you what, I thought that General Ritchie had been given a rotten deal because, you know, he hadn't the troops nor the weapons that Montgomery had. Montgomery had everything, and as regards Montgomery, he wouldn't move an inch until he got what he wanted. Now, I'm sure if Ritchie had the same...
Do you mean Orkin, same... that
court? No. I'm talking about Ritchie. Now, wait a minute.
The previous commander...
You see, now there was Wavell, which we had nothing to do with Wavell. Then there was... Was it Ritchie first, then Auchinleck, or was it Auchinleck, then Ritchie?
Not quite sure myself.
Your memory is faulty. But anyway, that the commander before Montgomery, if he'd had the same amount of troops and the weapons and what have you, he could have done the same as Montgomery.
What do you remember about the preparation? You were on the brigade staff as a what you described as a dog's body once.
Yes, I.
What do you remember about the preparations for El Alamein? In October.
Well, all I can remember that quite a lot of supplies were keep on coming up. As far as I was concerned, I didn't have a great a great deal to do then. Except, as I say, as I used to do in the Gazala, is to...
did you have to... Were you involved in camouflaging the movement of supplies and such like?
No. The only thing there was the preparing defences and taking some of our boys out at night time and digging holes and what have you. And that was about all. We did. The only thing is that, of course, we had to have the normal stand to in the morning and the stand to at night time. And I remember just prior to the breakthrough at Alamein, we had a rehearsal of the breakthrough, and I can remember this where they had a shoot with all the guns, prior to the big show.
The artillery, yes. During this rehearsal, were you aware of any people filming? Because there's been some rumours that some of the film taken of Alamein was actually taken of the rehearsal. Did you see any?
I never saw any films. None at all. No.
How did the rehearsal go for your brigade?
Well, I'll tell you what happened. This particular, when the rehearsal came on. Now it's funny this. Now I didn't realise that the breakthrough was going to be so soon, because I was going to go. Well, in fact, I did, but I was due to go and leave that particular morning. When I saw this rehearsal, I said, "Oh God, this is it. I've lost my leave." But I was allowed to go and leave, and I was away for, I think it was about a week, could it be? And when I came back, nothing happened until a few weeks after that, and then there was a big push.
So, what do you remember of the actual Alamein attack?
Well, it was a terrific barrage. No, I don't know how anybody survived it. It was when I was looking back at the barrage, it was just like a half circle, and you would think there was a gun every yard or so. That's what appeared. It was terrific. And then, of course, when the Germans gave themselves up. And some of the commanders were complaining. He said it was inhuman, that barrage, which it really was. But of course,
was it the biggest you ever saw?
Oh yes, yes.
What was the noise like?
Oh, it's terrific, terrific. I mean, there was big guns and the smaller guns going off, and it was very impressive to watch.
And what was your? Obviously, you wouldn't go over the top as a
no.
What was your job during the attack? What were you doing?
Well, the whole thing was that I remained with the defence platoon and brigade headquarters until they really pushed forward. Because we stopped where we were until we consolidated, you see? And then after that we carried on and then set up our brigade headquarters, as you move forward. But after that breakthrough, we were pulled out of the line.
Did you miss the fact that you weren't in the fighting so much as a staff officer, or were you quite relieved, or how did you feel about it?
Well, I don't know.
Because you knew more that was going on, but you were less involved.
Yes.
You did less of it.
I would say one thing. I mean, I was lucky. I think that if I hadn't been with brigade headquarters, I wouldn't have been talking to you now. It was like that.
And did you appreciate that at the time?
Oh, I appreciate it at the time. But mind you, I will say that probably I'll talk about it later on, but I mean, there was times when I used to go with the brigadier walking about when there was a battle going on. Him dolled with his red hat on, his red band on, and that was very scary. That was later, that, yes.
So that around this time, so that you were moving forward with brigade headquarters, not really, didn't see much of the battle, there's not much point.
Well, I mean, No.
And around this time, Percy was sacked, wasn't he?
Well, what
it was quite controversial.
What happened was, you see, that Montgomery had given orders that the 9th DLI was to As soon as they break through, they were to more or less chase the enemy up the coast road. And Montgomery came along and saw the 9th DLI marching up the road. And he stopped and wondered, asked what was happening. And indeed, he said that they should have been in trucks following. Now, I don't know who's to blame, whether it was the communications been bad as regards Colonel Percy's concern, but in fact, after that, he got what we used to commonly call a bowler hat.
And how did you feel? I mean, you'd worked with Percy a lot.
Well, I felt very sorry for him.
Was he upset?
Oh, yes, yes.
Did he show it?
No, he didn't show it. But when he actually left, I went and saw him, shook hands with him, and told him how sorry he was, and I could see how upset he was, because after that he went back to Egypt and commanded a Noctu there, lost his command, and it broke his heart, really, it did, because he supposedly died on the way home to England, but afterwards learned that what had happened was he committed suicide on the way up on the boat.
Now, the replacement was Beak, I think.
Brigadier Beak,
and,
yes.
Was it difficult for him to come in after the sacking of, you know, the predecessor?
No,
did it make any difference?
Now, Brigadier Beak was a VC, and he'd earned that VC in the First World War in the Navy. Yeah, it's unusual, isn't it, for a naval officer to command a brigade, an army brigade, but I thought he was very good.
What was good about him?
Well, he was more active. He was I don't think he was a great one for paperwork, whereas the other brigadiers I knew were, you know, spent a lot of time in paper. He liked to be about and see for himself. I remember at the Battle of Marath, where I had to go with him, which I mentioned before, where he says, "Come on, we'll go and see what's going on."
We'll come to that when we get
will
to
you come
Marath.
Later on, yes,
what kind of a man was he? Was he a nice chap? Or?
He was a man who would stand no nonsense. He was down to the point. He wouldn't mince matters. He said what he wanted, and if he didn't get what he wanted, there was he totally knew in certain terms that he wasn't very happy about it.
And did that make him difficult to deal with?
No. I got on very well with him. Yes.
Did he mix with his staff much?
Yes.
In the mess, I mean.
In the mess, oh yes. Mm-hmm. But then again, we didn't have much. The mess life was entirely different to what it was in Gazala, because in Gazala we were stabilised, and for a while we were there for I can't remember how, it was weeks we were there, you see, and therefore you were allowed to establish a mess where, as I said, the mess we had was quite a palatial mess for a battle area. I mean, there was no furniture. The furniture was all seats were sandbags and whatever. The tables were sandbags, but you know, we had a big, it was like a big hole with a tent on top. Whereas the mess was all the mess was a cook's vehicle with an awning down either side, where one side was for the cooks and the other side was for the mess.